Case number 07-7141. Ahmed Chalabi et al. Appellants versus Heshimite Kingdom of Jordan et al. Mr. Markham for the appellants, Mr. Curran for the appellees.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. I have requested, if it's permissible, 3 minutes rebuttal time out of my 15 minutes. Thank you. May it please the court, this is a case which is still at the pleading stage, where the pleading is given all deference, and as this court has repeatedly said, cases are not dismissed on the pleading unless there is no doubt but that the plaintiff can show no set of facts under his pleading that entitles him to any relief. That is the standard that the court below used when scrutinizing our initial claim that the sovereign nation of Jordan had crossed over the line and was engaging in a commercial activity and thus not acting as a sovereign and thus not immune from suit here because they were running a business. The court, indeed, in construing our allegations, gave them the credit that they deserve at this stage, particularly because they were so specific, and noted that he could not grant a motion to dismiss under 12b1 or 12b6, given the broad standard of what is of the construction of the pleadings in favor of the plaintiff. And he said, commencing on or after the seizure of Petrobank on August 3, 1989, defendants assumed control over Petrobank's day-to-day operations to the same extent as had a private individual and continued the activities. Based upon that, he simply said the pleadings have alleged an exception to the commercial activity, an exception to the sovereign immunity. He was correct, undoubtedly, under the pleading. Then he turns to the statute of limitations issue and says, well, wait a minute. The seizure was in 1989, and they knew of the seizure, so they were on notice. So the longest statute of limitations imaginable, 4 years under RICO, has long since run, and therefore they're out on statute of limitations ground. Yet in doing that, he ignores the many allegations in the complaint by which we say, allege, just as he credited in the commercial activity exception language that he cited to sustain jurisdiction at the pleading stage, that this was a continuous tort. We alleged that it was a continuous tort generally. We then specifically said that the bank, as operated by Jordan, that Jordan continued to hold assets that they had seized, that they were still selling off these assets as of the time of the complaint, that they had sold off 750 parcels of land, yet they retained the proceeds, that they had 1,300 additional pieces
of property. The injury occurred in 89 and 90 when they seized the bank and liquidated it. I mean, under your theory, a statute of limitations would never run.
Well, Your Honor, as long as they held this property, they could have given it back. They could have sold it and made the disposition available to the shareholders on whose behalf we're suing derivatively. That's not what they have done. We allege that they are continuing to sell off this property despite our demand that they give us back the bank to operate. Yes, some of the injury undoubtedly occurred when the bank was seized, but it depends on what happened after that. And what Jordan could have done was what happened in the Baglab case, which we cited in our brief. The Bank of England came in to run an ailing bank, seized it, put in new management, and then stood back and let them operate it. We contend that Jordan has continued to loot the bank up until the time that the complaint was filed, and that some of these injuries are ongoing. We allege specifically that they have taken 130 million dinars, which is more than that in dollars. I'm not exactly sure the exchange rate right now, and that they have taken it and they're holding it in another bank rather than distributing it to the shareholders, rather than doing the things they should be doing. So this injury is continuing, and we have the cases
that we see. The injury is continuing, but the tort is not.
It is as long as they're holding money that doesn't belong to them, Your Honor. They could give it back.
What about Fitzgerald, D.C. Circuit case? Mere failure to right a wrong and make plaintiffs whole cannot be a continuing wrong, which tolls the statute of limitations.
Well, were that all, the particular wrong, if it's an assault, if it's something that has a finite end, but if you're continuing to take property, Your Honor, and hold it, under the Perry Baugh case, they decided that property being held in banks that was seized during World War II by the Nazis, that was still an ongoing tort because it could give it back. The continuing holding on of it is continuous. The selling off of it and pocketing the money, selling it to your cronies over in Jordan at a discount rather than selling it at fair market value and distributing to the ship, that is, we allege, an ongoing tort. Discovery would clear up whether or not...
So if someone steals my car, and 10 years later I find out he's leasing it at below market rates, statute of limitations hasn't run?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know...
That's this case.
Your Honor, I respectfully know because...
The harm is being... whatever the bank is doing, it isn't harming Chalabi anymore.
Well, it's harming the shareholders on whose behalf he's suing derivatively. They're still selling it. Were this car, a car is a finite object. These pieces of property and the security, the stock that they grabbed from people and sold, and they're holding and they're selling off slowly, it's still going on. They don't have impunity.
That's so different from my hypothetical.
Well, Your Honor, with respect, I believe that if you look at all of the allegations that we have in our complaint about what they have continued to do, and we have alleged that they're continuing to do it, can it be said that there is no doubt but that nothing has happened since 2000, 4 years before we filed the complaint in 2004? There is no doubt that nothing was a continuing tort, a continuing wrong, a continuing conversion. The Perry Baugh case, where the seizures of the assets during the Nazi era were deemed to still being held because they could have given them back. It's a continuous wrong. It doesn't stop. You catch a thief 5 years later who stole your car and say, that's my car. No, it's not, and it's taken you too long. There are certainly issues that we have to deal with, Your Honor, in terms of latches. We have to point to specifics in terms of discovery. But I respectfully submit that the court could not have said below that, yes, after the seizure, which was the finite act, that he said could quite well have been regulatory, the allegation is that they continue to operate this bank in a manner inconsistent with our rights, and that continuous operation satisfies the commercial exception because of the day-to-day nature of it, using his words. I respectfully submit that that is equally so with respect to the continuous tort application. Otherwise, there are virtually no torts that aren't a continuous tort, because at some point some harm can be measured. Now, I believe, Your Honor, that the way this is decided in the D.C. Circuit is this. If there are harms that occurred back before the statute, in other words, during the time that has expired, you can't get damages for those. You have to prove that there was some additional harm occurring to you within the statute of limitations period, evolving from caused by the continuous tort. So that if you've got oil spilling over on your land starting in year one, statute's 3 years, in year five, the oil is still spilling. The law is that for what you can show to have been incremental damage during the statute of limitations, you're allowed to recover. I believe that covers Your Honor's hypothetical and shows that we have pleaded the difference, and we ought to be allowed to go to discovery to show what specifically happened during this period that was an additional harm for which recovery can be. The court below indicated that in connection with the commercial activity exception, which it said we had adequately pleaded, that it would be inclined to allow discovery limited to that issue so that it could sort out jurisdiction first. The overlap between continuing day-to-day operations, which form the basis of the commercial activity exception, the overlap of that with the continuous tort and what damages you suffered during the applicable, recognizable damage period is remarkable. It's almost parallel. The case should be sent back. It should be remanded for that purpose. There should be an agreement between the parties sent to the court. This is discovery you're allowed to take. go get it, come back to me with the facts, and I'll decide whether anything's occurred within the statute. And whether
you've argued this case, as I understand it, in terms that we have to find that you, in fact, have pled a continuous tort. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe that's the ruling that I would urge on the court.
At least insofar as it would entitle you to discovery in order to demonstrate what you've cited as the Beard exception, that if you can show these later acts within the statute of limitations, then you can recover damages for them.
That we can show that we can do discovery on that, and we can put forth the facts we already have to back up our claim. We're not just saying, give us a chance to poke around.
What is the current?
Can I just follow up? What I'm concerned about is this, in part, is the Supreme Court said it was disapproving of the theory of hypothetical jurisdiction. If the court was going to engage in lawmaking functions. Then subsequently, the Supreme Court said, well, piggybacking on Steel Company, there are exceptions. And the exception it cited in the Sinochem case involved forum nonconvenience, and it referred also to personal jurisdiction. What I need to be clear about, and I'll ask Appelli as well, is what's the Supreme Court saying, in effect, that it's permissible to, as it were, assume jurisdiction, taking the allegations of the complaint as true. And insofar as you can dispose of the case before you, it's permissible where the case is not over. And by that I mean, if you failed on the grounds of personal jurisdiction, or if you're in the wrong forum, the case itself is not over. You can go to the proper forum and proceed. But what's the Supreme Court saying that if you're going to go forward and determine the merits of the case in the sense that the case is over, and you would face an estoppel if you tried to file the case again, that under those circumstances, you can't proceed on the basis of assuming that you have jurisdiction? I mean, is that where the Supreme Court is drawing the line, or is it so fuzzy that we just deal with these cases on an ad hoc basis?
I think it's fuzzy because the rules of pleading are intact, Your Honor, for this purpose. And it's Rule 12 and the way it construes Rule 8 and the pleading requirements. There are some heightened pleading requirements in Rule 9 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, for example, fraud specificity. There are a series of cases which the Supreme Court batted away from my circuit, where I practice normally, the First Circuit, where the First Circuit had alleged, oh, no, in a civil rights case, a racial discrimination case, you have to show with specificity something. And the Supreme Court said, where's that in Rule 9? We have a set of rules that govern this, and if Congress wants to amend them to say, wait a minute, when you're suing a sovereign, you've got to put in some sort of a factual showing or some sort of a proffer so we can get going. I think until they do that, under the regular rules, the way this ought to work, given as yet the fuzziness from the Supreme Court on it, is simply this. If the court finds that it has jurisdiction at a certain particular point, it ought to go forward, based on the pleadings, it ought to go forward and find out whether that is so. And probably the better approach, but frankly, I don't care which of it, because we're going to get to the same result anyway, probably the more logical approach would be to do this. You've pleaded enough to get jurisdiction, but in deference to the sovereign here, I want to have limited discovery, so you pony up what it is you have to back up your allegations, factually what you have, documents, witnesses, statements, and then we'll come back here right away. Now, in the case.
So you don't see any contradiction between the determination the termination of the case based on this type of hypothetical jurisdiction and what concerned the Supreme Court and Steel Company?
Logically, I think there could be in that, before you decide something on the merits, you ought to perhaps, but again, the Supreme Court is fuzzy, you ought to have verified that the power that the allegations say that you have as a court actually exists as a matter of fact.
I mean, I think you can argue that it's fuzzy in the sense that this court doesn't specify what it means by the lawmaking power in terms of saying, no, you must first establish jurisdiction before you enter into the lawmaking power. But so far it hasn't had that, the case like this case, where your case is over if we were to affirm the district court as distinct from the cases that have been before the Supreme Court.
That is correct. I'm happy to sit here as long as Your Honors want me to, but
Counsel,
my time.
Thank you very much.
Time is up. Would I have 1 minute of rebuttal, or did I lose it all?
We'll give you some time.
Thank you very much.
May it please the Court, I'm Christopher Curran of White & Case on behalf of the Kingdom of Jordan and the other appellees. With me in the courtroom today are representatives of the Jordanian government, including the Jordanian ambassador to the United States, Prince Zayed. I propose to address the statute of limitations issue and the FSIA immunity issue, and then I would also like, of course, to comment, Judge Rogers, on what I would characterize as the sine chem issue on the sequencing of arguments. Starting with statute of limitations, I think it's pretty clear and perhaps undisputed on the record here that the core allegations of Mr. Chalabi occurred in 1989 and 1990, and that he had knowledge of all the information necessary to have the claim accrue at that point in time.
But the fact that there's a liquidation, does that necessarily give you some evidence that the assets that the bank has will be looted?
Well, I guess I would respond to your question this way. It's clear from the record here, as pleaded by Mr. Chalabi, beginning in paragraph 62 of his complaint, he relies upon Resolution 490. Mm-hmm. Resolution 490, which we've put into the record, as we're entitled to do since he referred to it and relied upon it, establishes that Chalabi's interest and the interest of all the shareholders was extinguished upon that liquidation order.
Well, the subpart that you rely on is talking about the debts of the bank, and that's all it's talking about. It's not talking about shareholder interests.
Well, I think if you're referring to the provision in liquidation decree 490, that is setting forth the priority for the distribution of any remaining assets of Petrobank.
As to, quote, the debts, that creditors will receive the money in this following order. But it doesn't say anything about shareholder.
Well,
that's all I'm getting at. In other words, as I take your brief, you're saying that this court would have to find that 490 eliminated any shareholder interest.
Well, I think the record is clear that it did. And let me elaborate a little bit on that. Okay, we've referred the court mainly to Ziadat Exhibit T, and specifically in the appendix, I believe it's at page 426. But that can be read in context by reference to Exhibit S as well, which is the governor of the central bank's recommendation. And in that recommendation, the governor of the central bank points to the Arthur Andersen report and observes that the Arthur Andersen report establishes that the bank's liabilities exceed shareholders' capital by a substantial amount and potentially by an even greater amount. Okay. On the basis of that finding, the governor of the central bank recommended to the ESC the issuance of the liquidation decree. And then when you look at the liquidation decree, when it's listing the distribution for assets, the last one is the distribution to remaining creditors pari passu.
All right, but what about the later allegations of looting? That's what I'm
saying. Doesn't matter. I mean, once Chalabi's interest is extinguished in 1990, whatever's done with Petrobank after that doesn't exacerbate any injury he's had, and he's got no interest in it.
His complaint alleges in paragraph 14 that he is a shareholder.
Well, it does say that, yeah. And maybe he is a shareholder, but the shares he holds are worth zero, and that was established back in 1990, and that can't change based on any alleged looting or anything else that occurs after his interest is extinguished.
No, I'm trying to understand that, assuming you are correct, that in 1990 shareholder interests were extinguished. Nevertheless, even you acknowledge that the bank has continued to operate so that there may be new shareholders, if I can put it that way.
Well,
and Mr. Chalabi, he says he currently owns these shares, is what I'm getting at. Now, maybe that is not true, but, I mean, we're at the pleading stage here, and we're taking the allegations if his complaint is true.
But he's the plaintiff, and he's alleging... he acknowledges, in fact, he hasn't disputed that his shareholder interest was extinguished back in 1990. He didn't dispute that in the district court. He hasn't disputed it in his briefs here.
Well, I'm not sure I would agree. In the district court, he kept urging the district court that he was entitled to discovery. All right? And the district court proceeded on the basis that it was assuming the allegations of the complaint were true. And those allegations include paragraph 14.
Well, whether there was looting or not, and again, we dispute it, but we accept it for purposes of this.
No, I'm not making any allegation about there was. I'm simply saying that's what the complaint alleges.
It's legally irrelevant.
Okay.
It's legally irrelevant because Chalabi's interest was extinguished in 1990. This is no different from the Wrong case, the unfortunately named Wrong, R-O-N-G case, where this court, including two members of this panel, concluded that an expropriation extinguished the interests of the shareholders whose corporation had been expropriated, and that any subsequent conduct dealing with the assets that were expropriated doesn't create commercial activity, and by the same analysis, shouldn't give rise to any basis for continuation of the claims accruing. I agree with what Mr. Markham said when he was up here, that there is a similarity in the analysis between the commercial activity exception and the statute of limitations exception. But we went under both under the proper analysis because, as I've already stated, for statute of limitations purposes, the claim accrued in 1990 upon the liquidation decree. Chalabi was out then. Anything that occurred after that didn't affect him one iota. So the statute of limitations should be done. And his reliance on Jung and Beard and any of the other statute of limitation cases is unfounded because in all of those cases, I would rely on the Fitzgerald case that Judge Tatel referred to before. Fitzgerald was a situation where the wrong occurred. And once that wrong occurs and there's the failure to cure it, it does not continue the statute of limitations period. In contrast,
he had a financial interest. He alleges a financial interest in the bank. I'm translating what you said. He alleges that he was deprived of that financial interest as in 89-90, right? At which time he had zero. The fact that Jordan still had some of the physical assets, if it did, he alleges, still has some. Is really quite irrelevant. Money's fungible. He lost everything in 1990, and the fact is that if he's entitled to recover it in 2008, he can recover it. It doesn't have to be the same bills that were in the bank. It's just totally fungible. But so what Jordan does with it is completely irrelevant to the question when his claim accrued, right?
That's right. And it's similar to Judge Tatel's car. You know, if there are cigarette burns in it by the guy who stole it, that doesn't change the fact that Judge Tatel's claim arose when his car was stolen.
What the fair market value of the car was then, not what it is now, 10 years later.
Right. Now, I'd like to move a little bit to the FSIA immunity issue, because that's one where I think Judge Oberdorfer went off the track a little bit, because our position is that the activity upon which Mr. Chalabi's claim is based is quintessentially sovereign activity and not commercial activity. Chalabi's beef with Jordan is the issuance of laws, decrees, and the implementation of those by regulators.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because as I read the hearing transcript, and in the context of our Phoenix Consulting case, your argument did two things. One, it said, well, assuming the allegations of the complaint are true, we still win. And then I thought you said, well, even if they're not, I'm putting words in your mouth at this point, even if we're not, we win. But in the even if we're not argument, one of the points you made was that Mr. Chalabi had lost all his interest in the bank back in 1990. So you were challenging a factual allegation in the complaint.
I don't agree with that, Judge Rogers.
Okay.
I don't think I said anything that raised a factual issue. I mean, from...
But you said he had lost all his equitable interest.
That's based on Resolution 490, which is alleged in his complaint.
But all I'm getting at is that's challenging a factual allegation in the complaint.
Oh, I don't think it is. I think that's relying on his factual... That's turning his factual allegations against him. If he refers to and relies upon a resolution, and we show the court that resolution, and the terms of that resolution extinguish his interest, I think he has been hoisted on his own petard, and I don't think that transforms anything under Phoenix Consulting or any other analysis.
Well, I understand your point; it's well taken. But in order to make your point, you have to go beyond 490 into these declarations and the Arthur Anderson report, et cetera.
Well, everything that is attached to the Ziadat Declaration is either a statute or a court decision or is something referred to by Mr. Chalabi in his complaint. We have not introduced any extraneous facts. Therefore, I think this is a pure facial challenge to his complaint. Perhaps I should address the sequencing point under Sinochem. And I pointedly refer to Sinochem rather than Steel Co. or Rurgas or others, because I think Sinochem is the current lay of the land.
My point is it said personal jurisdiction forum non-convenience. You're out, but your case is not necessarily over.
Right, and I think the same is true for statute of limitations. I think analytically the holding of Sinochem, and before that, Papandreou in this court, is indistinguishable from a statute of limitation situation. And here's why. In Sinochem, the Supreme Court was very careful to point out that it was not asserting the law-making authority. It was instead denying a forum. And that's why it was appropriate to address forum nonconvenience ahead of a complete disposal of jurisdictional issues. Same here. I think what Judge Oberdorfer did was appropriate. I of course disagree with his conclusion on FSIA immunity, but if he really found that it was an intractable issue that required some other discovery or factual development and so forth, I think he was perfectly within his discretion to address the statute of limitations.
Isn't this all much simpler than that? There's a footnote in Steel Co. that says there are and distinguishes a prior Supreme Court decision on the basis that the Steel Co. opinion only applies to Article III jurisdiction.
Yes, yes.
Not statutory standing, for example. And if there's, this is not standing, but it's immunity and it can be waived, so it doesn't have that kind of straight jurisdictional. It's not Article III jurisdiction by any stretch of the imagination.
That's right.
And so you can dispose of it on an alternative ground. The Supreme Court said as much.
Yeah, and the First Circuit this year has issued an opinion saying just that. In fact, I'll give you the cite to it. It's Greenwood versus New Hampshire Public Utilities Commission, 527 F3rd 8 at 13, and they're making the exact point you're making, Judge Randolph, about Article III versus maybe statutory jurisdiction or something like that. Here, I don't think there's any question that Article III jurisdiction exists. So,
case or controversy, right?
That's right.
Everybody has standing. So.
That's right, and I think it's also within the jurisdictional grant to the federal courts under Article III. So, Judge Rogers, I hope that this response addresses your concern about the sequencing. Unless there are any other questions from the court, I'll sit down now. We ask, of course, that that the matter be affirmed, at least on statute of limitations, but perhaps as well on the FSIA immunity or active state. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Markham, your time expired, but we'll give you 2 minutes.
Very well. Thank you very much. Your Honors, we allege that the, quote, liquidation, unquote, was not, in fact, a liquidation. It was named a liquidation so they could continue to operate the bank and seize it. We do not allege that our rights were extinguished at any particular time, either Chalabi's direct rights or his rights derivatively as a shareholder. Our allegations, if taken as true, say that this bank was seized and operated continuously, with assets being dribbled out and sold for cheap to their cronies, or sold in the money pocketed by the government, kept, auctioned, sold off. We allege it all. And were we allowed to have...
What's the injury from that? If he is totally deprived of any interest in the bank as of 1990, what is his injury from whoever took over the bank of dribbling out assets?
I believe it's the if with which our pleading disagrees. Clearly, if everything he has is gone as of 15 years ago, then whether there's a cigarette burn in the car later on, if it's gone, it's gone. That concept seems to me clear, Your Honor. But there's a big if, that his rights are distinguished. We do not allege that our rights were extinguished in 1990, far from it. We allege that this was a sham liquidation done under the pretext of a fake audit report, allowing them to take the bank and run it into the gutter for their purposes. The courts in this district, in this circuit, have said that even if the government cloaks what it's doing with some sovereign purpose, a government can always do that. You look at the character of the act, its nature. You don't look at what the government calls the act. And our allegations don't call it a liquidation that terminates his rights. Simply never did that, never alleged that. With respect to the discovery that we would ask for on the continuing tort, it would be a very simple matter for us to show which of our currently existing interests have been damaged within the applicable statute of limitations periods. I believe that's what the precedent of this court says. Thank you very much. We'd ask that the case be reversed and remanded for further discovery.